All right, now we're online. Did you receive my email on the psychic being?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. So I just.
I didn't read it. I must admit, I've been very busy,
Okay.
but
But in case it's focalizes on that topic, and
I
so
will read
maybe.
it. I needed the reminder, I think.
But if everything is clear, it's not necessary. I mean, it's already tough enough here what we have on the synthesis of yoga. So, what were your, sorry, Andre, I had interrupted you. You were saying? No? Okay.
What page are we
So,
starting on?
I have 149 on my edition at least. It is paragraph 16 of the Askent of the Sacrifice.
Ascent, huh? Oh, gotcha.
Ascent, as
Ascent.
as as the ascent, ascent of
Sorry,
the sacrifice.
it's a teacher habit I have to correct people sometimes.
You
I
should,
try
you
to fill
should.
it most of the time, but
Absolutely. The problem with me is that I read a lot, almost everything in English, but I don't talk much in English. So I don't
So
know. I
same in
don't
your
know
mind.
if I'm pronouncing it in my mind probably wrong. And I could, it has crystallized. My personal English has crystallized, and it's difficult now. I'm sorry for
It's
that.
like you say integral. I love it when you
In
say it because it,
integral,
yes,
integral.
but it's
Now I got it. I got it.
I've become associated with you and integral, and I kind of like it
Integral, because in German
now, but.
you say integral, right? Integral, so and you say,
It's
well,
okay.
it's the
It's okay.
same word, more or less. Try to
Good.
guess what could
Okay. I know, exactly. So.
Okay, I have Andrea, me, Geoffrey, and John Robert in as
Okay.
sequence.
And
Jeffrey, you'll ring the bell for a few
I
minutes.
will, yes. We ready for meditation? Thank you.
If knowledge is the widest power of the consciousness, and its function is to free and illumine, yet love is the deepest, most intense, and its privilege is to be the key to the most profound and secret recesses of the divine mystery. Man, because he is a mental being, is prone to give the highest importance to the thinking mind and its reason and will, and to its way of approach and effectuation of truth. And even if he is inclined to hold that there is no other, and even he is inclined to hold that there is no other. The heart, with its emotions and incalculable movements, is to the eye of his intellect an obscure, uncertain, and often a perilous and misleading power, which needs to be kept in control by the reason and the mental will and intelligence. And yet there is in the heart or behind it a profounder mystic light, which, if not what we call intuition, for that, though not of the mind, yet descends through the mind, has yet a direct touch upon truth and is nearer to the divine than the human intellect in its pride of knowledge. According to the ancient teaching, the seat of the immanent divine, the hidden Purusha, is in the mystic heart, the secret heart cave, Hridaye Guhyam, as the Upanishads put it. And according to the experience of many yogins, it is from its depth that there comes the voice or the breath of the inner oracle.
This ambiguity, these opposing appearances of death and blindness, are created by the double character of the human emotive being. For there is in front in man a heart of vital emotion similar to the animals, if more variously developed. Its emotions are governed by egoistic passion, blind instinctive affections, and all the play of the life impulses with their imperfections, perversions, often sordid degradations. A heart besieged and given over to the lusts, desires, wrath, intense or fierce demands, or little greeds and mean pettinesses of an obscure and fallen life force and debased by its slavery to any and every impulse. This mixture of the emotive heart and the sensational hungering vital creates in man a false soul of desire. It is this that is the crude and dangerous element, which the reason rightly distrusts and feels a need to control, even though the actual control, or rather coercion it succeeds in establishing over our raw and insistent vital nature remains always very uncertain and deceptive. But the true soul of man is not there. It is in the true invisible heart, hidden in some luminous cave of the nature. There, under some infiltration of the divine light, is our soul, a silent inmost being of which we are even aware, of which few are even aware. For if all have a soul, few are conscious of their true soul or feel its direct impulse. There dwells the little spark of the divine, which supports the obscure mass of our nature, and around it grows the psychic being, the formed soul, or the real man within us. It is as this psychic being in him grows and the movements of the heart reflect its divination and impulsions that man becomes more and more aware of his soul, chooses to be a superior animal, and awakening to glimpses of the Godhead within him, admits more and more its intimations of a deeper life and consciousness and an impulse towards things divine. It is one of the decisive movements of the integral yoga when the psychic being liberated, brought out from the veil to the front, can pour the full flood of its divinations, seeings, and impulsions on the mind, life, and body of man, and begins to prepare the upbuilding of divinity in the earthly nature.
As in the works of knowledge, so in dealing with the workings of the heart, we are obliged to make a preliminary distinction between two categories of movements: those that are either moved by the true soul or aid towards its liberation and rule in the nature, and those that are turned to the satisfaction of the unpurified vital nature. But the distinctions ordinarily laid down in this sense are of little use for the deeper spiritual purpose of yoga. Thus, a division can be made between religious emotions and mundane feelings, and it can be laid down as a rule of spiritual life that the religious emotions alone should be cultivated, and all worldly feelings and passions must be rejected and fall away from our existence. This, in practice, would mean the religious life of the saint or devotee, alone within the divine or linked only to others in a common God love, or at the most pouring out the fountains of a sacred, religious, or pietistic love of the world outside. But religious emotion itself is too constantly invaded by the turmoil and obscurity of the vital movements, and it is often either crude or narrow or fanatical, or mixed with movements that are not signs of the spirit's perfection. It is evident, besides, that even at the best, an intense figure of sainthood, clamped in rigid, hieratic lines, is quite other than the wide ideal of an integral yoga. A large psychic and emotional relation with God and the world, more deep and plastic in its essence, more wide and embracing in its movements, more capable of taking up in its sweep the whole of life, is imperative.
A wider formula has been provided by the secular mind of man, of which the basis is the ethical sense. For it distinguishes between the emotions sanctioned by the ethical sense and those that are egotistic and selfishly common and mundane. It is the works of altruism, philanthropy, compassion, benevolence, humanitarianism, service, labor for the well-being of man and all creatures that are to be our ideal. To shuffle off the coil of egoism and grow into a soul of self-abnegation that lives only or mainly for others or for humanity as a whole is the way of man's inner evolution according to this doctrine. Or if this is too secular and mental to satisfy the whole of our being, since there is a deeper religious and spiritual note there that is left out of account by the humanitarian formula, a religio-ethical foundation can be provided for it. And such was indeed its original basis. to the inner worship of the divine or the supreme by the devotion of the heart, or to the pursuit of the ineffable by the seeking of a highest knowledge, can be added a worship through altruistic works or a preparation through acts of love, of benevolence, of service to mankind and to those around us. It is indeed by the religio-ethical sense that the law of universal goodwill or universal compassion or of love and service to the neighbor, the Vedantic, the Buddhistic, the Christian ideal, was created. Only by a sort of secular refrigeration, extinguishing the fervor of the religious element in it, could the humanitarian ideal disengage itself and become the highest plane of a secular system of mental and moral ethics. For in the religious system, this law of works is a means that ceases when its object is accomplished or aside. For in the religious system, this law of works is a means that ceases when its object is accomplished or a side issue. It is a part of the cult by which one adores and seeks the divinity, or it is a penultimate step of the excision of the self in the passage to nirvana. In the secular ideal, it is promoted into an object in itself. It becomes a sign of the moral perfection of the human being, or else it is a condition for a happier state of man upon earth, a better society, a more united life of the race. But none of these things satisfy the demand of the soul that is placed before us by the integral yoga.
Altruism, philanthropy, humanitarianism, service are flowers of the mental consciousness and are at best the mind's cold and pale imitation of the spiritual flame of universal divine love. Not truly liberative from ego sense, they widen it at most and give it higher and larger satisfaction. Impotent in practice to change man's vital life and nature, they only modify and palliate its action and daub over its unchanged egoistic essence. Or if they are intensely followed with an entire sincerity of the will, it is by an exaggerated amplification of one side of our nature. In that exaggeration, there can be no clue for the full and perfect divine evolution of the many sides of our individualized being towards the universal and transcendent eternal. Nor can the religio-ethical ideal be a sufficient guide, for this is a compromise or compact of mutual concessions for mutual support between a religious urge, which seeks to get a closer hold on earth by taking into itself the higher terms of ordinary human nature, and an ethical urge, which hopes to elevate itself out of its own mental hardness and dryness by some touch of religious fervor. In making this compact, religion lowers itself to the mental level and inherits the inherent imperfections of mind and its inability to convert and transform life. The mind is the sphere of the dualities, and just as it is impossible for it to achieve any absolute truth, but only truths relative or mixed with error, so it is impossible for it to achieve any absolute good. For moral good exists as a counterpart and corrective to evil, and has evil always for its shadow, complement, almost its reason for existence. But the spiritual consciousness belongs to a higher than the mental plane, and there the dualities cease. For there, falsehood confronted with the truth by which it profited through a usurping falsification of it, and evil faced by the good of which it was a perversion or a lurid substitute, are obliged to perish for want of sustenance and to cease. The integral yoga, refusing to rely upon the fragile stuff of mental and moral ideals, puts its whole emphasis in this field on three central dynamic processes: the development of the true soul or psychic being to take the place of the false soul of desire, the sublimation of human into divine love, the elevation of consciousness from its mental to its spiritual and supramental plane, by whose power alone both the soul and the life force can be utterly delivered from the veils and prevarications of the ignorance.
It is the very nature of the soul or the psychic being to turn towards the divine truth, as the sunflower to the sun. It accepts and clings to all that is divine or progressing towards divinity, and draws back from all that is a perversion or a denial of it, from all that is false and undivine. Yet the soul is at first but a spark and then a little flame of Godhead burning in the midst of a great darkness. For the most part, it is veiled in its inner sanctum, and to reveal itself, it has to call on the mind, the life force, and the physical consciousness, and persuade them as best they can to express it. Ordinarily, it succeeds at most in suffusing their outwardness with its inner light and modifying with its purifying fineness the dark obscurities or their coarser mixture. Even when there is a formed psychic being able to express itself with some directness in life, it is still in all but a few smaller portion of the being, no bigger in the mass of the body than the thumb of a man, was the image used by the ancient seers. And it is not always able to prevail against the obscurity or ignorant smallness of the physical consciousness, the mistaken sureness of the mind, or the arrogance of the vehemence of the vital nature. This soul is obliged to accept the human mental, emotive, sensational life as it is, its relations, its activities, its cherished forms and figures. It has to labor to disengage and increase the divine element in all this relative truth mixed with a continual falsifying error. This love turned to the uses of the animal body or the satisfaction of the vital ego. This life of an average manhood shot with rare and pale glimpses of Godhead and the darker luridities of the demon and the brute. Unerring in the essence of its will, it is obliged often under the pressure of its instruments to submit to mistakes of action, wrong placement of feeling, wrong choice of person, errors in the exact form of its will, in the circumstances of its expression of the infallible inner ideal. Yet, is there a divination within it which makes it a surer guide than the reason, or than even the highest desire? And through apparent errors and stumbling, its voice can still lead. And yet, is there a divination within it which makes it a surer guide than the reason, or than even the highest desire? And through apparent errors and stumblings, its voice can still lead better than the precise intellect and the considering mental judgment. this voice of the soul is not what we call conscience, for that is only a mental and often conventional erring substitute. It is a deeper and more seldom heard call, yet to follow it when heard is wisest. Even it is better to wander at the call of one's soul than to go apparently straight with the reason and the outward moral mentor. But it is only when the life turns towards the divine that the soul can truly come forward and impose its power on the outer members. For itself, a spark of the divine, to grow in flame towards the divine, is its true life and its very reason of existence.
At a certain age in the yoga, when the mind is sufficiently quieted and no longer supports itself at every step on the sufficiency of its mental certitudes, then the vital has been steadied and subdued. At a certain stage in the yoga, when the mind is sufficiently quieted and no longer supports itself at every step on the sufficiency of its mental certitudes, when the vital has been steadied and subdued and is no longer constantly insistent on its own rash will, demand, and desire, when the physical has been sufficiently altered not to bury altogether the inner flame under the mass of its outwardness, obscurity, or inertia, an inmost being, long hidden within and felt only in its rare influences, is able to come forward and illumine the rest and take up the lead of the sadhana. Its character is a one-pointed orientation towards the divine or the highest, one-pointed and yet plastic in action and movement. It does not create a rigidity of direction like the one-pointed intellect, or a bigotry of the regnant idea or impulse like the one-pointed vital force. It is at every moment and with a supple sureness that it points the way to the truth, automatically distinguishing the right step from the false, extricates the divine or Godward movement from the clinging mixture of the undivine. Its action is like a searchlight showing up all that has to be changed in the nature. It has in it a flame of will insistent on perfection, on an alchemic transmutation of all the inner and outer existence. It sees the divine essence everywhere, but rejects the mere mask and the disguising figure. It insists on truth, on will and strength and mastery, on joy and love and beauty, but on a truth of abiding knowledge that surpasses the mere practical momentary truth of the ignorance, on an inward joy and not on mere vital pleasure. For it prefers rather a purifying suffering and sorrow to degrading satisfactions, on love winged upward and not tied to the stake of egoistic craving or with its feet sunk in the mire, on beauty restored to its priesthood of interpretation of the eternal, on strength and will and mastery as instruments not of the ego but of the spirit. Its will is for the divination of life, the expression through which it is of a higher truth, its dedication to the divine and the eternal.
But the most intimate character of the psychic is its pressure towards the divine through a sacred love, joy, and oneness. It is the divine love that it seeks most. It is the love of the divine that is its spur, its goal, its star of truth shining over the luminous cave of the nascent or the still obscure cradle of the newborn Godhead within us. In the first long stage of its growth and immature existence, it has leaned on earthly love, affection, tenderness, goodwill, compassion, benevolence, on all the beauty and gentleness and fineness and light and strength and courage. on all that can help to refine and purify the grossness and commonness of human nature. But it knows how mixed are these human movements at their best and at their worst, how fallen and stamped with the mark of ego and self-deceptive, sentimental falsehood, and the lower self profiting by the imitation of a soul movement. At once emerging, it is ready and eager to break all the old ties and imperfect emotional activities and replace them by a greater spiritual truth of love and oneness. It may still admit the human forms and movements, but on condition that they are turned towards the one alone. It accepts only the ties that are helpful, the heart's and mind's reverence for the guru, the union of the God seekers, a spiritual compassion for this ignorant human and animal world and its peoples, the joy and happiness and satisfaction of beauty that comes from the perception of the divine everywhere. It plunges the nature inward towards its meeting with the immanent divine in the heart's secret center. And while that call is there, no reproach of egoism, no mere outward summons of altruism or duty or philanthropy or service will deceive or divert it from its sacred longing and its obedience to the attraction of the divinity within it. It lifts the being towards a transcendent ecstasy and is ready to shed all the downward pull of the world from its wings in its uprising to reach the one highest. But it calls down also this transcendent love and beatitude to deliver and transform this world of hatred and strife and division and darkness and jarring injustice. It opens to a universal divine love, a vast compassion, an intense and immense will for the good of all, for the embrace of the World Mother, enveloping or gathering her, or gathering to her her children, the divine passion that has plunged into the night for the redemption of the world from the universal inconscience. It is not attracted or misled by mental imitations or any vital misuse of these great deep-seated truths of existence. It exposes them with its detecting search ray and calls down the entire truth of divine love to heal these malformations, to deliver mental, vital, physical love from their insufficiencies or their perversions, and reveal to them their true abounding share of the intimacy and the oneness, the ascending ecstasy, and the descending rapture.
All true truths of love and of the works of love, the psychic being accepts in their place. But its flame mounts always upward, and it is eager to push the ascent from lesser to higher degrees of truth, since it knows that only by the ascent to a highest truth and the descent of that highest truth can love be delivered from the cross and placed upon the throne. For the cross is a sign of the divine descent barred and marred by the transversal line of a cosmic deformation which turns life into a state of suffering and misfortune. Only by the ascent to the original truth can the deformations be healed and all the works of love, as too all the works of knowledge and of life, be restored to a divine significance and become part of an integral spiritual existence.
comments, questions?
Well, I thought it was worth reading in one go to get a sense of the larger, because I don't think I got that, the earlier reading that we did.
Yeah. In fact, sometimes I'm a bit confused because I think to understand, to know and to get it, and then suddenly he says something and everything crumbles down again. Because, for example, where he says, this voice of the soul is not what we call conscience. Ah, okay. I all the time thought that it is the voice of the conscience. So it's not. Okay, so I have to rethink this through again. The point is, how do we relate this theoretical knowledge to our inner experience? Yeah, that's a bit, yeah, this is trying us to feel this inner soul, which has this, the word desire is wrong now in this context, is this want to the desire, this desire for the divine, this divine desire for the divine, this the natural sensation for beauty, love, harmony. That's, I think, more or less in one form or another, everyone has this. But the point is, how much is vital and how much is psychic? And to be able to discriminate between the two things, this is a difficult thing. And probably what we perceive is a mixture of both. And this, so it's neither one thing, neither purely vital beings, but also evidently far from being purely psychic beings and persons, personality, I mean. Yeah, and where then he says, and on an inward joy and not on mere vital pleasure, for it prefers rather a purifying suffering and sorrow to degrading satisfactions. Yeah, I think that all sufferings comes from probably us not following this inner soul intimations, probably. If we would be able to do that, probably no suffering. Mothers also said this, and there's sunlit path. There's a sunlit path where she said, if you surrender, evolution must not necessarily be a history of sufferings and fallback and pain and this up and downs. It can be a luminous path, but we have to surrender. Yeah.
Okay. That's the trick.
That's the trick.
Good luck.
Let's do it. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's hard to understand mentally. I had a teacher one time, and after I had been around her for quite some time, I could sit in the same room with her and I could feel this vibration coming from her of love, and yet it was absolutely impersonal. It was impersonal. Yeah. It had nothing to do with what I wanted or liked or anything like that. And I never felt that before. I never felt that from a human being before that time. And yet it was very pure, it was very benevolent, but it was not about my ego at all.
Yeah, the people say you cannot love without having someone or something to be loved. So this is a mental mistake, I think, a vital mistake. You can love without an object of love. Or the only object, so to speak, is the divine or God or whatever you want. But still difficult, yeah. Love with, or even worse. No, I mean, even more difficult, not worse. Even more difficult is to love unconditionally. Yeah, that's psychic, I think. The idea to love unconditionally. Also, people who hurt you, who you don't, who may not even deserve, or deserve, I don't know. This is the idea of what deserves is, even, again, a mental idea. But evil people you don't like you and hurt you and are unjust, and you love it, love them nevertheless. That's psychic, I think. Yeah? So just to put it into context, just to have an idea what we are talking about. Because when people speak about love, I recall Mother saying that the nearest human love to the psychic love is the love of a mother for a child. Yeah. But she said even that is still not psychic. But it is perhaps the nearest thing that we can. Well, I'm not a mother. I don't even have a father, but so it's even more difficult for me. But yeah, maybe mentally it's easier to. But yes, it's something that is much further away than we think. I believe, and I don't mean it in a negative sense now here. But it's easy to misinterpret this. That's what I mean.
I think what the chapter indicates is how easily it gets influenced by lower parts of us, yeah, by the ego being. Because the ego is always trying to stay in, yeah, control, right? That's its task. Mm. It's got to be on top. And yeah, and so that is the long, patient work to detect it and to surrender, you know, to surrender that over and over. Yeah.
Sri Aurobindo's thoughts and aphorisms have some really striking, almost, they're almost like haikus, you know, there's sometimes just a few lines where he just puts it so vividly. This is an example, although it's not specifically about love. God had opened my eyes, for I saw the nobility of the vulgar, the attractiveness of the repellent, the perfection of the maimed, and the beauty of the hideous.
Yeah.
And this one also, when I had the dividing reason, I shrank from many things. After I had lost it in sight, I hunted through the world for the ugly and the repellent, but could no longer find them.
Yeah. You cannot longer find it.
So there's an interesting article I read this week in The Guardian on free will. There's a...
Ah, yeah.
I don't know if any of you saw it, but...
Yeah.
It's sort of a discussion of scientists and how the fact that contemporary scientists are increasingly skeptical of the idea of free will, a growing number of scientists. And so it was a rather kind of pessimistic article I found, because sort of suggested, well, if there's no free will, then nobody can be held accountable for their actions. And you know, I don't think it quite works that way. I don't think, the non-existence of free will means that nobody can be held accountable anymore. It puts us in the heart of paradox, is what it does. Instead of assuming that everything is up to us, we have to struggle with the fact that there are necessities of being and there are, the needs of the self to have some kind of freedom. And so you work with that paradox. It's not, anyway, it was my own take on it. But the idea of submission is also one that goes with a sense of a larger will, let's say, than the human will, right? Yeah. So,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they a priori do not accept this idea of a larger will. So if you take this away, you are almost impelled to believe that there is no free will, especially if you have this mechanistic, naturalistic idea of evolution, of life, of our biology, of everything. Then it's almost inevitable that you don't believe in free will. We are just robots, biological robots, that's all. But I'm not sure that there is an increasing number. Yeah, this is what the article says, but
yeah.
But I found many scientists, not necessarily now specifically to the question of free will, but there is a turn, a transformation, a change of mind in many scientists that were previously diehard materialists, and now these things are softening. They may be not just there where Sri Aurobindo is, but the teleological, that means the purpose in nature, that there is more behind than just matter and physics. This is an idea that is creeping through more and more also in the scientific environment, I think. It's my personal subjective feeling. I don't have statistics. I didn't make a poll or so, but it's my feeling that it is growing. It's perhaps still a minority, but it is a growing minority, I think. Yeah. And by the way, what is will? And who is supposed to be free from what? I think that's so vague, and they pretend to know everything. There are interesting experiments that they have made about on free will. There's this experiment of Benjamin Libe, and you can see everyone interprets this experiment as they wish and they want, because at the end the result is such that the interpretation depends from the ideological mindset that you have. And every one of us has some sort of ideological mindset, if you like it or not. And these are not, the materialists tend to take these experiments as conclusive. But if you look and analyze these, I have done a bit of this, and they are not conclusive at all. Quite the contrary. They, in a certain sense, they are suggesting what Sri Aurobindo is saying here, that we are not made just of a body and of a soul, but there are many sheets, layers in between. There's also the mind, the vital. There is something that goes beyond the mind, the overmind, supermind. And then there is not just this desire body, but there's this psychic being. And but this, it is not just the usual soul people are speaking about, but it is something more, in some sense, it's more complicated than this on and off white, black and white thinking that still in the philosophical and scientific community we still have. Yeah, okay, this was enough for the philosophical detour.
So for me, the essence of the free will is that we have given the choice to turn to the divine or not.
Good definition, yeah. I like that, yeah.
As a basic freedom of choice.
Oh, wonderful.
That is the original desire in the absolute, that its creation would turn around to join, to become one with that of which it originated.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, I don't like definitions, but characterization of what free will could be. Yeah, but unfortunately, you cannot tell this to a scientist because a scientist says, well, there is no divine. What divine? Well, that's rubbish. I don't
well, there's
believe
not much
in that.
Point in talking to people who can't hear.
Yeah, but not all scientists are so. I'm not trying to flatten out this, but it is a sort of scientific. You cannot bring this forward as a scientific argument, and nevertheless, it may be more truthful this characterization of free will than any other mental scientific characterization, because. Yeah.
Well, I think the whole essence of it is that it includes the levels beyond mind.
Yeah.
And
they still conflate consciousness with mind, but consciousness is one thing and mind is another thing.
Exactly. Yeah? That's a differentiation.
They conflate it, they put it together, and therefrom comes an enormous confusion. Also, because I have followed a bit this philosophy of mind discussions and so. And then what I mean by consciousness, someone else means something completely different. Because what is consciousness? So, but it is something undefinable. But in science, speaking about something that is not definable, then they tend to not define it at all and put it together with other things. It becomes difficult at the mental level. And that's why they are still there. And there's a so-called hard problem of consciousness. There has substantially been no real progress at all.
It's like it's trying to study a level that is beyond mind with the mind.
Yeah.
It's a contradiction in itself.
Exactly.
So as long as the mind is king, you can't see what consciousness is.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to open up to something way beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here we have also all this hype with artificial intelligence. So my conjecture is that we, in the next years, we will not see this great breakthrough in artificial intelligence. Why? Because mind is not physical. Yeah, that's our conjecture here, and that's what our yoga tells us here. Mind is one thing. Body is another thing. Soul is yet another thing. Something beyond mind. And to try to reconstruct the mind with a purely physical mean, if this is true, that it cannot be just equated one-to-one, then it cannot succeed. So let's see in the next 10, 20, 30 years.
200.
No, I don't think so. I think in 20 years maximum, they will say, okay, we failed. And perhaps even much, much sooner. Already some science, some critics are already there and are saying, we are not going in, we are not having these results that you read in the newspapers. Yeah, okay. So...
Well, I guess we filled the hour.
Yeah. Should we begin the chapter 6 or leave it there? I don't know. I'm open to suggestions.
I have some issues.
Okay.
I've got to move my car, and otherwise I'm going to get a ticket, so. They were cleaning the streets and they woke me up this morning to say, if you don't move your car, you're going to get it towed. So,
oh dear.
It was nice that they called because they never used to. So,
wow.
You already had a session before this session, I saw in the forum. You said that you.
No.
You just. No? I saw it.
No, I had
misread you probably.
Yeah.
Because someone was speaking of the synthesis of yoga. Who could this be? On the Infinite Conversations? Perhaps it was an old post, not
maybe.
A recent post.
Yeah.
Okay.
So shall we just start again next time and then we'll start with chapter 6?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
If that's okay. Yeah.
Of course. Good. course.
Okay. Gotta... Perfect. Few minutes, maybe meditation.
Okay.
Concluding meditation.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for accommodating my needs.
Of course.
Good to see everybody today.
Yeah, beautiful. Till next time.
Yeah. Adios.
Bye-bye. Adios.